You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller. Today we're going to start off with a recipe from, you guessed it, smittenkitchen.com. This for corn cacio e pepe. As the year is not 2017, when a cacio e pepe frenzy outside of Rome, where it's never not on the menu, seemed to have peak frenzy when I put cross between potatoes Anna and cacio e pepe on the cover of my second cookbook, I'd only chosen the dog days of summer of 2023 to talk about cacio e pepe once again for a single reason, a worthy update. The only thing I love more than the combination of salty, funky pecorino cheese and copious amounts of black pepper kicking up sparks of heat on a tangle of a linguine is the way that I make it in the summer, adding sweet, crunchy corn. It is, full stop, the perfect complement to the punchy cheese sauce. They are made for each other. If you're getting deja vu because I shared a version of this in 2019 in my Bon Appetit column about feeding picky eaters. But in an effort to make it in as few steps as possible, I added the corn to the pasta cooking water 30 seconds before the pasta was done. Faster, easier, everyone wins, right? But it never struck me for at home. Sometimes a small extra strip is worth it, and I so vastly prefer this with the corn first blistered in a pan that I held off for 4 years, but I cannot keep this truth to myself any longer. Something amazing happens when you add fresh corn to a thin layer of oil in a scorching hot pan. The undersides toast and crisp, a few kernels jump in the air, whoopee, and the whole thing smells a little like popcorn in a way that quickly simmered corn could never. This dish has everything, ease and depth, seasonality and seasoning, and I hope you get obsessed with it too soon before the corn is gone and the cardigans arrive. Here we go, corn cacio e pepe. Servings 4, takes 25 minutes, source Smitten Kitchen. This recipe is adapted from my 2018 foolproof cacio e pepe, which uses a technique from the chef of Flavio al Valle Vevedote, sorry for any mispronunciations there, in Rome, which I learned via tour guide Elizabeth Mincilli. To understand why starting with a cold sauce works, read the 2018 headnote. You can watch me make this without corn on YouTube, and there's a link at smittenkitchen.com. This recipe works best with cheese from a block, not pre-grated. The directions below are highly detailed, even for me, because I want you to get this perfect too. You'll need 2 tablespoons of olive oil, about 3 cups of fresh corn kernels from 3 medium-large ears, kosher salt, freshly ground black pepper, 1 tablespoon of butter, salted or unsalted, 1 pound of dried linguine or another pasta of your choice, 8 ounces of pecorino romano cheese cut into 1-inch chunks plus extra gratings for garnish. Prepare the corn. You're going to heat a large skillet or the empty pot you will use to cook your pasta in on high heat for 1 minute. Once hot, add the olive oil and let the oil heat for 1 minute. Add the corn kernels and season them with salt and freshly ground black pepper and stir them once or twice just so they're evenly coated in the oil and leave them be. Do not stir again for 3 to 4 minutes or until toasty brown underneath. Step back as they might crackle and pop, especially towards the end. Add butter and stir to combine, then scrape everything into a bowl and set aside. Next, you're going to cook the pasta. Bring a pot of well-salted water to a boil and cook the linguine until about 30 seconds short of perfect. We're not going for a full al dente here because the pasta dish is finished off the heat, thus will not continue cooking. Before you drain the pasta, reserve 1 cup of the pasta cooking water and set aside. Meanwhile, make the sauce. Get your sauce ready before the pasta has finished cooking, as we want to add it to piping hot noodles. In a food processor or high-speed blender, blend the pecorino and approximately 2 teaspoons of freshly ground black pepper until the cheese is as fine as pieces as it can get. Add 3 to 4 tablespoons of cold water, one at a time, and fully blend each addition before adding the next. You're looking to take the cheese from a powdery to a creamy consistency, like frosting for a cake. Blend the mixture as long as is needed. It'll be about 1 minute to get it there. And then taste the mixture. It should be very salty and peppery. Add more pepper if needed. Aged pecorino is usually very salty, but if you're using something else, add salt here too. Next, you're going to assemble and eat. As soon as your pasta is drained, add it back to the empty pot along with the black pepper pecorino sauce. The sauce will be too thick for the job, but do your best to distribute it evenly over the noodles. Then, begin adding the reserved pasta water, 1 to 2 tablespoons at a time, tossing the pasta the whole time. This will loosen the cheese mixture into a nice saucy consistency. Keep adding water, tossing the whole time, but not so much that the sauce washes off the noodles. And add the reserved corn and toss to mix. Then transfer everything to a serving bowl. Finish with more cheese and black pepper and eat right away. As far as doing ahead, this is not my favorite dish to reheat, but you can make the corn in advance, an hour or day, just reheat it. And the cheese pepper sauce up to a week in the fridge, and have everything ready to go when the pasta is piping hot. Our next recipe is going to be for ultimate zucchini bread. I love zucchini bread personally, that's the narrator talking here, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about Deb's recipe. I have a few complaints about zucchini bread, and I bet you cannot wait to hear them. I bet you were thinking, I was hoping to hear more complaining today than I usually do, or, wow, Deb is really going hard on the zucchini content this summer, isn't she? It's all fair and true, but if you, like me, couldn't help but notice that a lot of zucchini bread recipes could be better, well, pull up a chair, you are among friends. The first thing that I've never understood about 90% of zucchini bread recipes out there, including my own earlier one, is why they make 2 loaves, but 2 squat ones. Why do we settle for this when we'd rather have 1 great one? Can't we decide for our own selves when the time is right to scale it up to 2? I like loaf cakes that are filled out and domed. I like craggy, crunchy tops. You have to constantly swat hands away from picking off and bark-like flecks, usually failing. But who can really blame anyone? I've never understood why zucchini bread doesn't have more zucchini in it. Is it because, quote, cake with a few disparate flecks of zucchini in it is less intimidating, end quote? Is it because cake with a substantial amount of vegetables inside doesn't rally the base? My goal was never to replace my salad quota with zucchini bread, but the presence of zucchini actually makes for a better, more tender cake. So we should embrace it. Some recipes tell you to grate zucchini just to wring it out, which to me is a monstrous extra step. This style of cake is called a quick bread. I take the quick to heart, and I see no reason to dry out your zucchini when the moisture within it is what makes zucchini bread great. Also, every recipe that tells you to grate 1 zucchini should be canceled. Zucchini can range from a few ounces to a couple of pounds, and I doubt any recipe could use both interchangeably. I like 1-bowl cakes, and I don't think anyone making zucchini bread is hoping to get all fancy with it. What if you could just mix it with an electric mixer? No weight, a whisk, a fork? I want more fork-mixed cakes. It's homey food. It should be hurdle-free. Finally, every single recipe, including my earlier one, lies to you when it fails to tell you that the best time to eat zucchini bread is 1 day after you make it. While this is true for many cakes, for zucchini bread, the difference is so significant it should be non-negotiable. I also think that we need to talk about how to wrap it so it's not compromised in any way when you do eat it tomorrow. If you wrap it, you lose the crisp top. So why achieve it just to give it up? I have not found the moisture of zucchini bread to be notably compromised by keeping it unwrapped on top, especially not with this recipe. But I do leave it in the pan, so this is all the protection that it needs. Here is the recipe, Ultimate Zucchini Bread. This serves 8 to 10, takes 1 hour and 20 minutes, plus overnight cooling. You'll need 2 cups of grated, packed zucchini, not wrung out, grated on the large holes of a box grater. You'll need 2 large eggs, 2/3 cup of a neutral oil, I use safflower, olive oil, or melted unsalted butter. You'll need 1/2 cup of packed dark brown sugar, and then 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 1 teaspoon of fine sea or table salt, 1 1/4 teaspoons of ground cinnamon, 1/8 teaspoon of ground or freshly grated nutmeg, 3/4 of a teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder, 2 cups of all-purpose flour, and 2 tablespoons of raw or turbinado sugar. You're going to heat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Lightly coat a 6-cup or a 9x5-inch loaf pan with non-stick spray. Place the grated zucchini in a large bowl and add oil, eggs, sugars, vanilla, and salt. Use a fork to mix until combined, and then sprinkle the cinnamon, nutmeg, baking soda, and baking powder over the surface of the batter and mix until combined. And then, for extra security that the ingredients are well dispersed, give it 10 extra stirs. Add flour and mix until just combined. Pour into a prepared loaf pan and smooth the top, and then sprinkle with the raw or turbinado sugar. Don't skimp. Bake for 55 to 60 minutes until a toothpick or tester inserted into the middle cake, but also into the top of the cake, closer to the dome, comes out batter-free. Let it cool completely in the pan. Leave in the pan unwrapped overnight or 24 hours until removing carefully so not to ruin the flaky lid, and serving in slices. Next, we're going to have lemon bars. Who doesn't love lemon bars? These are bold and tart lemon bars, ones I feel are best in smaller doses than In a Garden suggests. I have made a few changes to the recipe, increased the salt in the crust, reduced the sugar in the lemon filling, and an encouragement to grease your pan, as mine were all but cemented into their nonstick pan. For those of you who like the 1-to-1 crust to lemon layer ratio, use the second option. So for the crust, you'll need 1/2 pound of unsalted butter at room temperature, 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 2 cups of flour, 1/8 teaspoon of kosher salt. For the full-size lemon layer, you'll need 6 extra large eggs at room temperature, 2 1/2 cups of granulated sugar, 2 tablespoons of grated lemon zest, that's from 4 to 6 lemons, 1 cup of freshly squeezed lemon juice, and 1 cup of flour, and confectioner's sugar just for dusting. So if you want a thinner lemon layer, you need 4 instead of what I just said, with these 6 extra large eggs, you'll use 4 extra large eggs at room temperature, 1 2/3 cup granulated sugar, 1 tablespoon plus 1 teaspoon of grated lemon zest, that's from 3 to 4 lemons, 2/3 cup of freshly squeezed lemon juice, and 2/3 cup of flour. And again, the confectioner's sugar for dusting. You're going to preheat your oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and grease a 9x13x2 inch baking sheet. For the crust, you're going to cream the butter and sugar into light in the bowl of an electric mixer fitted with your paddle attachment. You're going to combine the flour and salt, and with the mixer on low, add to the butter until just mixed. Then you're going to dump the dough into a well-floured board and gather into a ball. Flatten the dough with the floured hands and press it into the greased baking sheet, building up a 1/2 inch edge on all sides. Then you're going to chill that. Bake the crust for 15 to 20 minutes until very lightly browned. Let cool on a wire rack and then leave the oven on. For the lemon layer, you're going to whisk together the eggs, sugar, lemon zest, lemon juice, and flour, and then pour over the crust and bake for 30 to 35 minutes, less if you are using the thinner topping, or about 5 minutes beyond the point where the filling is set, and then let it cool to room temperature. Cut it into rectangles and dust with confectioner's sugar. Our next recipe is for our favorite chocolate chip cookies. Yum! I suppose there comes a point in every food blogger's so-called career when she posts her favorite chocolate cookie recipe, but I have avoided this point for a long time because does the internet actually need another chocolate chip cookie recipe? 130,000 times no. But the thing is, I do have a favorite. And sometimes when you're making a heavy meal full of classics that I'll get to one by one this week, you want to end on a simple but not too subtle note. See, this cookie has what we affectionately call, quote, a lot of chocolate to very little dough, end quote. In fact, when you're folding all the ingredients together, it seems impossible that so many chocolate and pecan chunks will fit into so little batter. And the best part is that they barely do. Who is the crazed handsome genius who brings us this masterpiece? Nope, not Alex, although he did bake the cookies while I washed dishes on Sunday. See how we switched it up there? Crazy. It is and really just has to be the famed David Leibovitz from his Great Book of Chocolate. And yeah, I was the last person on earth to buy this, but I've made up for it by making these cookies more than twice. More than twice. You have no idea how few recipes get even one repeat performance in the Smitten Kitchen. Twice means that you need to print, yep, it's working again, and this print this post and go make these right now. In 30 minutes, you're going to be all Schmollhouse who? And you will never look back. So this is for our favorite chocolate chip cookies from the Great Book of Chocolate. So here's my chocolate chip cookie thing. The nuts are always well toasted and they're always finely chopped, as in some will be the size of petite peas, but many will be more like powder. What this gets you is a cookie filled with all of the awesome flavor of nuts as well as the extra crunch without the nuts actually interrupting your chocolate chip experience. Nobody wants their chocolate experience interrupted. Half the people who try them will have no idea that there are nuts in there at all, thus hushing the nut haters, but they will know that there is something undeniably better. This makes 20 cookies or more if you use one of these tiny cookie scoops. You'll need 1/2 cup of granulated sugar, 1/2 cup of firmly packed light brown sugar, 8 tablespoons of unsalted butter, cold, cut into 1/2-inch pieces, 1 large egg, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda, 1 1/4 cups of all-purpose flour, 1/4 teaspoon salt or 1/2 teaspoon of flaky sea salt, this is the dead option, and 1 1/2 cups of semi-sweet chocolate chips, 1 cup of walnuts or pecans, toasted and chopped. You're going to adjust the oven rack to the top third of the oven and preheat to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Then line 3 baking sheets with parchment paper. Beat the sugars and butters together until smooth. Mix in the egg, vanilla, and baking soda. Stir together the flour and salt, and then mix them into the batter. Mix in the chocolate chips and nuts. Scoop the cookie dough into 2 tablespoon balls and place 8 balls spaced 4 inches apart on each of the baking sheets. Bake for 18 minutes or until a pale golden brown and then remove from the oven and cool on a wire rack. Store at room temperature in an airtight container for up to 3 days. That's a good one. I like that recipe and would love to try that later today. So our last recipe is going to be for exceptionally grilled chicken. I'm going to skip all the commentary and just get right to the recipe. This serves 4, takes 40 minutes active time, and it's from Smitten Kitchen and Gourmet from 2003. At the end, there are 3 vinaigrette sauce options. I could never choose a favorite, but shown here is the first one adapted from Gourmet. Note, the chicken quantity here is relatively small. It works for our family on weeknights. You probably won't regret doubling it, and you'll want to double the vinaigrette dressing you use as well if you do that. Finally, if you don't have a grill, you can blast your chicken in oiled, shallow baking pans on a very hot oven, 500 degrees, until the skin is crisp, and then reduce the heat to 400 degrees and roast the rest of the way for about 30 to 40 minutes total cooking time. So first we're going to start with the brine. You're going to need 2 quarts of cold water, 2 tablespoons of granulated or brown sugar, 1/4 cup of diamond kosher salt. Use 2 tablespoons if you're using any other brand. 3.5 pounds of chicken parts with skin and bones, oil for the grill, and then to finish, 1 of the 3 vinaigrettes. We'll get to that. First, you're going to brine your chicken. In a large, sealable freezer bag or container with a lid, mix the water, salt, and sugar. Add the chicken parts and seal the container or bag. Refrigerate for 1 hour and up to 6 hours. When you can't wait any longer, remove from the brine and pat dry. Next, make your vinaigrette. Whisk together 1 of the ingredient combinations below in a large bowl and set aside. Next, prepare your grill. If you're using a gas grill, heat all burners to high for 10 minutes, then adjust to moderately high right before you add the chicken. If you're using a charcoal grill and you have enough room to do so, leave about 1/4 of the grill free of charcoal and the rest of the charcoals until they are grayish white, about 15 minutes. Then you're going to grill your chicken. Lightly oil your grill racks and arrange the chicken on racks. Cover with a lid and cook until well browned, turning over once, about 6 to 8 minutes total for smaller parts, that's wings, thighs, and drumsticks, and 8 to 10 minutes for the breasts. Once the chicken is well browned, if you're using a gas grill with multiple sections, turn off the center heat and move chicken pieces onto it. If you're using a gas grill with 1 heat control, reduce it to medium. And if you're using a charcoal grill and have left an area free of charcoal, move the chicken onto it. Cook the brown chicken covered with a lid, moving the chicken around the grill as needed and turning over occasionally until cooked through, anywhere from 12 to 20 minutes, less for smaller parts, of course, gas grills tend to take longer, or until a thermometer inserted into the deepest part of your piece of chicken is 160 to 165 degrees. When the chicken is almost done, place lemon or lime halves, if you're using, cut side down, uncovered, over the lit burner until the grill marks appear, about 2 to 3 minutes. To finish, transfer your chicken to a bowl with a vinaigrette and toss to evenly coat. You can also cover this bowl with foil to keep it warm until needed, and serve the grilled chicken with grilled lemons or limes, if using, and any extra vinaigrette on the side. Here's the vinaigrette recipes. Garlic lime herb. You're going to whisk 2 tablespoons of lime juice, 1 tablespoon fish sauce, 1 minced garlic clove, 1/2 teaspoon dark brown sugar, sriracha to taste, together in a bowl, and then slowly drizzle in 1/4 cup of a neutral oil, whisking the whole time. Stir in 1/4 cup of chopped mint or cilantro or mix thereof, and have 2 limes halved crosswise ready to grill and serve. The next one is lemon herb. You're going to whisk 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, 1 minced garlic clove, 2 teaspoons of minced fresh rosemary or oregano, or a mix thereof, 1/2 teaspoon kosher salt, and 1/4 teaspoon of red pepper flakes together in a bowl. Slowly drizzle in 1/4 cup of olive oil, whisking the whole time, and then stir in 2 tablespoons of chopped flat leaf parsley. Have 2 lemons halved crosswise ready to grill and serve. For the salsa verde version, you're going to blend 1 cup of roughly chopped herbs, ideally mostly parsley plus a mix of mint, cilantro, thyme, and any other herbs you'd like with chicken, with 2 cloves of garlic, 1 anchovy, and 1 teaspoon capers with 1/4 cup olive oil in a food processor. Add the juice of 1/2 lemon, adjust to taste, add more lemon or olive oil as needed. If you wish, have 2 lemons halved crosswise ready to grill and serve. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.